to reflect a worldview of relatedness rather than a worldview of human superiority. An individual cannot thrive unless their neighbors thrive, because we're all dependent on each other.
Human beings. We all know by now that we can be a menace to the natural world, but can we also be medicine? With her latest project, best-selling author Robin Wall Kimmerer not only answers in the affirmative, but describes how restoring plants can restore our sense of reciprocity with the land, each other, and the earth. Kimmerer is the author of the runaway bestseller, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants, as well as Gathering Moss, A Natural and Cultural History of Mosses, and The Serviceberry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. She doesn't just study plants, she says, she listens to them. And with her brand new initiative, Plant Baby Plant, she is heeding a call to mobilize communities to restore plants in a way that, as she puts it, transforms love of land into social change through acts of creative resistance. Regeneration starts with seeds, stories, and remembering what it means to be a good relative, she writes. So let's get to it. It is my great pleasure and honor to have you with me here on Laura Flanders and Friends. Thanks for taking the time. I'm going to begin by asking you to introduce yourself. How would you describe who you are?
I would begin in my language and say bonjour and denoué malaganadok. Hello, my relatives. Shabadaske gishko kwena deshnakas. Bodwe wadmi kwenda. I've told you that my name and my language is light shining through sky woman, and I am a member of the Potawatomi Nation. I'm also a student of the plants, a mother, a grandmother, a professor of environmental biology at the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, and the founding director of the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment.
Well, we often begin, I know that I've come from somewhere, going somewhere, and so have you. So just to kind of settle ourselves, place ourselves in this conversation, who is uppermost on your mind or on your heart as we begin?
I am really deeply enmeshed in this moment at getting Plant Baby Plant off the ground, at trying to consider what does it mean to create community when we have only virtual tools. My favorite way to create in community is working with people in person, outdoors. But this is a whole new skill set for me, a whole new approach to creating community. So I'm thinking a lot about how can we act big in a microcosm.
One of the things that I've learned from your work is that, I think, if you'll forgive me, that if plants and animals had a preferred pronoun, it wouldn't be it. And that in your language, the Potawatomi language, it's not it. That grammar is different and that changes us. Can you talk about that?
Here I am spending my life literally on my knees before plants, learning from them. And then when it comes time to write about them, the English language not only gives me permission, but indeed a sort of a mandate that I have to refer to them as it, as if they were objects, these wise, brilliant teachers of mine. And I found the solution to that problematic objectification of other living beings as I was beginning to learn my own indigenous language, Anishinaabe Mo'an, or the Potawatomi language. And what you're referring to is that in our language, we speak a grammar of animacy. And so it's impossible to say it about plants or animals, or indeed any other living animate being. So there was a powerful moment in understanding the lens shift, the whole frame shift that happens with a different language, with a different worldview to view the plants, the animals, the waters as our relatives, not as our possessions, as our objects. And so I've been writing and working quite a bit in this field of thinking about how can we change language to reflect a worldview of relatedness rather than a worldview of human superiority and therefore extraction from the earth.
How do you also grapple with the grief that comes from that kind of heartfelt connecting to the world?
I think it is so important that we embrace ecological grief rather than look away. We have to embrace it. And the reason I say that is not only to ground us in the reality of what we are doing, but when we recognize that that pain that we feel for the natural world, for our relationships with the natural world, is also the measure of our love for the living world. And it is that love which is mirrored in the grief that makes you get back up and say, not on my watch. I love this land. I love these beings, my relatives, too much to stand idly by. And Lord, that's where baby plant came from. I give more than 100 talks every year. And at the end of those hours, people are weeping because they love the world so much. There is this longing to say, well, what can I do? What can I do with this love? And it is out of carrying that away from every audience that I thought, we have to push back against a worldview of drill, baby, drill, that will continue to lead us down that path and replace it with the notion of regeneration, of no, I am going to resist. I am going to ally myself with the plants who build biodiversity, who take carbon out of the atmosphere, who help us bring and build community. That plant, baby plant, grows directly from that grief, from that love, and from that longing, and offers an invitation to be in a more just and reciprocal relationship with land.
That relatedness comes up a lot in the serviceberry too. And I have to say that many of the sources that you cite in that book, which is a lot about economics, really, the economics of nature, are economists we've had on this program, people like Kate Raworth and Eleanor Ahlstrom and others. You bring, or maybe the Berries bring, another sort of perspective. Do you call it a kind of economy of nature? What do you call it? And how does it add to our picture of our relationship to the world?
My project in the serviceberry was, as an ecologist, to ask the question of why is it that we have created this human market capitalism, extractive capitalism, economic system, which is so at odds with the way that nature works. Nature doesn't promote scarcity and hoarding of capital or resources or private property. Nature is much more around circular economies. That there's no such thing as waste, is that the resource, if you will, is constantly in motion, being shared among all sectors of the natural economy, i.e. different species. And so serviceberry is really an inquiry into a kind of biomimicry. Could we engage the principles of biomimicry to think about a different kind of economy which doesn't destroy nature and human community, but in fact enhances it?
Well, this is exactly where you're going with Plant Baby Plant, and we're going to get right there next. But before we do, I just want to share with our audience, a few years ago, the good people at the Commons at the University of Kansas made this video of you taking us on a guided nature tour of the Clark Reservation State Park there in Janesville, New York. Check this out.
Just standing in this place, I see the food of the hickory, the food of the maples, the string of the basswood, And I see medicine right here in front of us. That black flaky bark is a black cherry. And did you ever wonder why cough drops almost always come in black cherry flavor? It's because black cherry is a cough medicine. And the bark of the twigs of that tree boiled down make a really good soothing cough medicine. And so, yes, you look at the world as full of biodiversity and these amazing beings living their lives, but they also are in relationship with us. And you see the cedars, really good respiratory medicine. We'll get close to one later. We came by a hemlock, which is super good for colds. It has tons of vitamin C in it. So they're medicines. They're medicines all around us to be honored, to be respected. And in fact, in our Potawatomi language, the word for plants is Mishkakin, which means the medicines, but it also means, if you take that word Mishkakin apart, it means the strength of the earth.
This is Laura Flanders and friends. Laura's guest today is plant ecologist, writer, and professor Robin Wall Kimmerer, author of Braiding Sweetgrass, often described as a hymn of love to the living world, and the founder of a brand new project, Plant Baby Plant, a movement for ecological action which aims to build community while deepening our relationship with the natural world. We just heard a clip featuring Robin Wall Kimmerer guiding us on a nature walk through the Clark Reservation State Park in Janesville, New York, an intimate invitation to see, listen, and relate differently to the land around us. That piece was produced by the Commons at the University of Kansas. You can watch this episode and join Robin on that nature tour at Clark Reservation Park and more at lauraflanders.org. While you're there, please subscribe to our newsletter to receive information on all of our web exclusives, including the full Anka conversation with today's guest. We'll be right back after a music interlude featuring Ode to Nature by Hoverfly from the Climate Soundtrack compilation produced by DJs for Climate Action.
The universe, unending stellar womb of all our days. Of ancient splendor.
I do have to ask you about some of the other people who draw on laws of nature or rules of nature, as they call them. Because it's not just you, I wish it was, but we also have eugenicists and white supremacists and Malthusians and people who preach a doctrine that they say is a natural doctrine of survival of the fittest and culling the herd. You've got broligarchs up there now saying that they're going to create a new planet, and that's what a new future species, or, you know, cultivate a new planet with enough science. Did they just get it wrong? Or are we in a contentious dispute here over the laws of nature?
The politic thing to say would be that we're in a contentious dispute. I think they plain old got it wrong, as has happened so many times. When people hijack science in order to support a political agenda. And over the last several decades, the research into cooperation, into mutualism, has repeatedly shown that mutual benefit, that cooperation can be selected for by evolution, by natural selection as well, and often is. And so this notion of nature red in tooth and claw is very much being replaced by this more, much more balanced framework to understand that all flourishing is mutual. An individual cannot thrive unless their neighbors thrive, because we're all dependent on each other.
I'm not indigenous, probably Celtic of some kind, who the heck knows, from Europe. I was trained in the kind of Marxist tradition, and Marx, it should be said, was very adamant that natural words like growth should not be applied to the man-made capitalist economy. He was very clear that there was a conflict there and that the language of nature shouldn't be applied to these man-made systems. And as I thought of your work, I thought how all of us, in fact, have been, Marx would use the word, alienated from that natural world, from our relationship to it. And for a lot of us, we've felt like, well, the best thing we can do is just leave it alone, not go there, not touch, not pick, not dig. But you're offering us another way to return to a reciprocal relationship. And that's a good long way of asking you a question about plant, baby, plant, I guess.
I love how you framed that, Laura, because it's really a very active choice and decision that we have to kind of decolonize our minds from this industrial revolution concept that the earth belongs to us, is a source of nothing more than belongings, natural resources that are our property that we're there to take. There is this notion in many indigenous worldviews that human beings play a critical role in maintaining balance, that the way that we take from the living world can actually be regenerative. Some of my own research with sweetgrass has shown that sweetgrass left alone declines. Sweetgrass harvested in a respectful, sustainable way doubles its population.
Give us some examples of this sort of creative resistance.
We know that forest health in this country declined when colonists came and suppressed indigenous fire, made it illegal to take care of the land using fire. My own ancestors could be jailed, were jailed, for setting cultural fires that are good for the land, that renew the land. And of course, that fire suppression under the colonial agenda led to forest situations that were ripe for wildfire, for catastrophic conflagrations, right? So there are so many examples now of the return of cultural indigenous burning in this country and all around the world. And it is renewing biodiversity, renewing forest health, and healing a relationship between people and place that say, we have to take care. We have to play an active role in caring for our land. So that's a very big and timely sort of newsworthy way of thinking about human intervention. But it can also be as small as replacing lawns with wildflower. When you convert a lawn into a wildflower meadow or perennials or native plant landscapes at an orchard for you and your neighborhood, suddenly you shift that balance. You're now sequestering, storing carbon in soil and in plant biomass. So you take an active step to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in the choices of your landscaping.
I am curious what you would like urban people to see as their role, because we can often feel very removed from even having a yard, but certainly from the natural world.
Well, in the plant baby plant movement, we recognize that not everybody has the privilege of caring for a piece of land. So one of our goals in plant baby plant is to heal land. But one of the other acts of creative resistance is to build community. And the third one is to build power. And building community and building power are, I think, the gifts of urban communities, right? The dialogue, the resources, the activation that can happen there to hold our leaders accountable, to direct resources to land care and to just political and green action. So we're absolutely mindful that this care for land doesn't just happen with seeds and a shovel. Can happen with a laptop and a ballot box and talking to your neighbors. Now, that's not to say that there aren't on-the-ground solutions in urban landscape. There are. Oh my goodness. Community gardens, community urban farming that does all those things. It heals land. It builds community and builds power as well. There's a wonderful movement called the Tree Equity Movement, particularly focused in our urban and to some extent suburban landscapes, which looks at the distribution of the benefits of nature, of a tree canopy. And when you look at that distribution in cities, what you find is not surprising, that it follows redlining, right? There is a huge justice gap between the access to trees and demographics in our cities. So the tree equity movement is one, and the community garden movement are ways that urban folks can participate. It's even been shown that the small act of pollinator gardens create resources when magnified over a whole block for pollinators and for birds.
I'm a big advocate of potlucks. Very simple, very pollinating of ideas and power and connections. Works for me. And there's another story that I was struck by as I looked at the history of braiding sweetgrass, your book, that sort of speaks to this as well. The book was published in 2013. You took it to a small independent publisher, Milkweed Editions in Minnesota. It didn't get any major reviews, but 7 years later, because of booksellers and buyers and word of mouth, it is a worldwide bestseller. You've got like 3 million copies sold, 20 languages it's been translated into. To me, that's sort of a lesson of reciprocity of a certain kind, people power. With your most recent book, Serviceberry, you're taking an action in the publishing too. When I got to the end of the book, I realized, oh, you're donating your advance royalties. To what extent is what you're doing, how you're doing it, also important to the message that you're bringing?
Thank you for realizing that, Laura. Exactly.
Great story.
Right? You know, we don't have to be complicit with these structures that are exploitive. And I love that. I love that the process by which we create community and share stories and try to catalyze a kind of cultural transformation to a reciprocal worldview rather than an extractive worldview. It matters how we do it. And I love, love, love your notion of a potluck. To me, in Plant Baby Plant, that's the vibe. That's what we want to create, is to say, let's come together, build a community which builds resistance in a time when we are increasingly in this hyper-individual, highly polarized environment.
Name one practice, perhaps, that we could all get better at as we try to implement what you're talking about.
I want to name two practices.
Go for it.
One, an internal practice of gratitude. Of being actively grateful for the gifts of the land, to name them, this big inventory of the abundance of the natural world. That has tremendous practical as well as spiritual and community value, because gratitude makes you want to give your gift back. And so the first is gratitude. And when activated to reciprocity by gratitude, to say, what could I give back to the earth in return for all of these gifts? Plant something.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask our closing question, which is about the story the future will tell of now. You've alluded to it, but what do you think is the story that the future, I don't know, 25, 50, 100 years, will tell about us in this moment?
That this is a time of remembering. when we cast off the stories that industrial colonialism told us of who we are as people, and we remember it, that we can be givers to the land. We remember that word is so important. I'm not just casting my mind back, but forward, because remembering our kinship with the living world and acting out of that kinship is the nature of this moment, the potential of this moment to be in the age of remembering who we are as humans.
Beautiful. Robin Wall Kimmerer, thank you so much for all your work and for Plant Baby Plant. I encourage people to check it out. It's been really a pleasure and an honor having you with me here on Laura Flanders and Friends.
Thank you, Laura.
It wasn't easy to separate people from plants and animals and nature. It wasn't easy. No, it took a lot of force. Just think of witch burning and enclosure and colonization, land theft and incarceration. And if you want to know more about any of those processes, you can through checking out the work of historians or my interviews with people like Sylvia Federici and Peter Limbaugh and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. No, it wasn't peaceful. It was brutal. But our behavior is still being modified today. Only this time, it's happening through processes so intimate we barely notice. The devices directing our attention today are all about that, directing our focus. From here to there, from this to that, from her to him. You get it. We hold screens in our laps, on our hands. We put buds in our ears and who knows what in front of our eyes. And that's changing us. So how do we resist? There have always been resistors. My favorite is put down the phone, go for a walk, make odd, unusual choices, see what you notice. I'd love to hear. You can find all my uncut conversations with our recent guests and our full archive through subscribing to our free podcast or my Substack or our newsletter. All the information's at the website. We are listener and viewer supported, and we thank you. We noticed you. Till the next time, stay kind, stay curious. For Laura Flanders and Friends, I'm Laura. Thanks for joining us.
For more information on this episode, check out our show notes posted for free at patreon.com/Laura Flanders and Friends. And we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel to watch the premiere of each week's show and chat in real time with Laura. The premiere now airs on Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern.
This show is produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, along with Sabrina Artel, Jeremiah Cothran, Veronica Delgado, Jeanette Hernandez, Jeannie Hopper, Sarah Miller, Nat Needham, David Neumann, and Rory O'Connor.
Thanks for joining us.
Cut to the Chase has a new time and day. Join me, Sylvester Rivers, every Friday at 8 a.m. as we share political realism.
Every candidate for Congress.
No fluff up in here.
They were given a pledge to sign.
Let's cut to the chase.
The pro-Israel lobby. You sign the pledge. If you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money.
Breaking down the lies.
4,500 U.S. military men and women lost their lives based on a WMD lie.
Cut to the chase every Friday, 8 a.m.
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Seth Parker Woods, Julia Bullock, and Connor Hanick on January 15th at the Nimoy. The powerhouse musicians unite for an evening that showcases Titan composers of lyricism and storytelling from the 20th and 21st centuries. Together, the musicians perform the works of George Walker, Nina Simone, and more. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM, and San